Hello, this is Anders Haglund, success coach from Sweden, and I have a special treat for you today because my guess is that pretty much all of us would like to both feel better and do better. And I can think of no one better for that purpose than my own personal coach, best-selling author of books like Feel Better Now, You Can Have What You Want, and the latest book, which is aptly named Supercoach, which was just released here in Sweden in Swedish, Supercoach to the Stars, Michael Neal. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Let's just dive right into it and start off with one of my personal things because, as you know, having you as my personal coach has turned a lot of things on its head from the old paradigm where I was. And my first question would be, what would you say is the most common mistake that we make as people when we start out in this human quest for being happy and successful?
Well, I think the most common mistake, and it's somewhat universal, is that we think that our happiness is going to come from outside us. So we think in some way we'll be happy when we get what we want. We'll be happy when things change. We'll be happy when the stars line up and the circumstances line up and we've got the right girlfriend, the right boyfriend, the right job, the right bank balance, whatever it is that we think is between us and being happy right now. And it's interesting that I found in my work that the really wealthy catch on to the error of this quite quickly because they've already achieved at an incredibly high level and they recognize that's not a source of true and lasting happiness. And sometimes the really poor, I don't just mean within a Western culture where it becomes competitive and comparative, but in other parts of the world where I've been, they it's weird to them the idea that somehow having more stuff or the right stuff would be what would make them happy. But the vast majority of us live somewhere in the middle. And yeah. And so we think the reason that we don't have this abiding sense of well-being in our lives is just we're not successful enough yet. So we might have a nice marriage, but we're behind in business, or we might be doing well in business, but our relationship with our kids is suffering, or we're doing well in business, we have a lovely relationship, but our health is bad. And we think there's a notion in the coaching world that's been very popular for a long time called the wheel of life. And you look yeah. at sort of 8 life areas. So you look at career and finances and friendships and family and personal success, and you give yourself a score from 1 to 10 in each thing, and you draw a circle, you sort of like a graph on a grid, like an asterisk, where there's yeah. the different lines representing the different things. And the theory is that when you're strong, when you score like 8 to 10 in all those areas, then the wheel of life is complete and you have this robust life. And there's a grain of truth in it, in the sense that if all those areas are strong, chances are you do have an abiding sense of well-being. But the cause-effect is backwards. In other words, what causes that wheel to be strong is that you're coming from that clarity and well-being. Yeah. The results it doesn't work in reverse. To try and reverse the process is like, because if a dog is happy, it wags its tail. But if my dog is sad and I grab it by the tail and try and wag it, that's probably not going to lead to a happier dog. And we do the same thing, is because we notice, gee, when I'm happy, I make good decisions, I get on well with other people, my relationships are really good, I'm able to do smart things business-wise, and things seem to kind of work out for me. And then we think that, okay, so if I want to, I can reverse the process. I can work on the business and work on the relationship and work on my self-esteem, and then happiness will follow. And it doesn't work any more than if you took a thermometer and poured extra mercury into it so that it was more full, that wouldn't make the temperature warmer.
No.
You can't actually take the feedback mechanism, which is how things are going in your life, and use that to control the temperature. And in the same way, you can't create happiness just by creating better circumstances.
Yeah, So would you say that this might have something to do, because in my experience when I talk to clients or people in general, it seems to be like people think that we get born almost like this empty shell, and then we learn things. We learn to tie our shoelaces, and then later on we learn to do our homework and our chores in the house, and for each level we are supposedly going up and being happier. At least mom tells us that you're a good boy when you do these things. And that actually sets us up thinking that if we could only do better, we'll get higher up on the levels, instead of seeing that we start out way up and we actually go down by the things we do. Would that be accurate?
Well, and I think it's because the kind of happiness that comes from pleasing mummy, you know, or mummy substitute throughout our lives, you know, our partner, other people, society, the culture, is our boss. You know, the problem is that's a sort of like an imitation happiness. That's a sort of a little high that we get in the moment, like a hit off a drug. And we can get hooked on that imitation happiness and go, ooh, I want more of that. I want more hits off this drug because I felt really good when they praised me. I got a really nice feeling inside, and I want more of that feeling, so I'm going to do more. And in fact, motivators in our culture, you know, there's a certain leadership style that's built around, you know, taking advantage of that fact and creating that sort of parental relationship with your team and trying to get them to perform at their best in order to please you or not disappoint you. That's one of the old paradigm ways of leading people. And it works to a certain extent because we are all conditioned in that paradigm. Where it ultimately breaks down is imitation happiness. No matter how much praise you get, that really is no substitute for that beautiful feeling that we're born with, from everything I can tell. I mean, I don't remember what it felt like to be a baby, but hanging around with my own kids when they were babies, hanging around with other babies, boy, there's a contact high that you get just from being around them. And later in life, when we drop into those states of profound well-being, we make up some reason for them. Oh, I'm having this profound well-being because I'm in a beautiful mountain setting by a stream. Or, oh, I'm having this feeling of profound well-being because I'm with the person that I love. Or, oh, I'm feeling this sense of profound well-being because I've achieved a big goal that I've been working on for a while. Well, actually, you're experiencing that sense of profound well-being because in that moment, for whatever reason, you're not distracting yourself from it by trying to do something else.
Yeah.
You know, babies are innately present.
Yeah, no, they're just there. They can be happy anywhere. So what would you say to somebody who says, like, oh, that sounds all good and everything, but it's a little bit fluffy and out there. What do I actually do? You know, that's the most common question. What do I actually do to find my inner wellness if it's there?
Well, it's sort of like asking, what do I do if I go bird watching? This is an analogy a friend of mine uses for it. If I go bird watching, well, what do I do to see the birds? Well, the first thing you do is you need to look in the direction that the birds are. And that's the first thing we don't do. Culturally, we spend all our time looking outside for which circumstances, which job, which activity, which person will make me happy. Well, you're never going to see the birds if you're looking in the opposite direction. So the first thing you do is you turn around. You turn inwards. You stop looking where the birds aren't, and you start looking where they are. And if you're not sure where they are, because people sometimes say, well, how do I look inside? Do I have to close my eyes? Do I have to do... Well, at least stop looking where they're not. Even if you don't know where to look, you do know where not to look. And what happens is because we have almost like a... It seems that people have a reset mechanism inside them. That when they stop trying so hard to find it outside themselves, it automatically just starts rising up on the inside. And there's a great story that a friend of mine told me about when he was learning to fly airplanes. And he was flying a plane called a Piper Cub. And it's a small plane. And there's this thing you have to do to get your license where you have to actually stall the plane. So you switch the engines off in the air. Always sounded kind of crazy to me. And stall the plane, and then you have to get it started again before you crash. And he was doing this, and the plane was spinning out of control, and he could not get it to right. He was pulling on I don't know what they call the steering wheel, but the equivalent of the steering wheel, as hard as he could to try and right the plane. And he's calling out to the tower, "Mayday, mayday, you know, I need help, 5796, you know, help me." And they were saying, "Let go of the controls, let go of the controls. You have to let go of controls immediately." And he said, no, you don't understand. I'm going down. The plane is going to crash. What do I do?" And he said, "This is a matter of life and death. Let go of controls immediately." And he was just scared enough that he did, and immediately the plane righted itself because it's got a built-in stabilizing system. And all his efforts to stabilize the plane were getting in the way of the natural stabilizing system that was built into the plane. Human beings have that same kind of built-in mental health, well-being stabilizing system. And the reason that we don't benefit from it more often is because we're so quick to try and fix it. If we feel bad, we want to fix it. If our partner feels bad, we want to fix it. If our team feels bad, we want to fix it or tell them to go fix it. And all that fixing, this culture of fixing, actually gets in the way of the natural self-righting mechanism doing its job.
So what about people who hear this, and maybe they're working as a leader in a company, or like most people, they are leaders in the family because they have kids, or somewhere else where they feel like, "Well, I can't just let go of the controls. Now people would just run rampant and do crazy stuff. And what do I do if I really want, you know, how do I help other people find this so that they will do better without wanting to, like, squeeze the controls?"
Well, the answer is always going to be that you need to know it for yourself first. In other words, not because Anderson and Michael say it, not because it sounds right. When you know for yourself, when you've experienced for yourself the self-righting mechanism, your own well-being and clarity coming back after a good night's sleep or after a walk or after a shower or after a break, when you experience that and you start to see, wow, this happens not just sometimes, this happens every time. Every time I let go of trying to make it all work, I get right back to my equilibrium. I find my bearings again. When you know that, it's just as easy to talk to your team about that as it is right now to tell somebody who is I'll use a golf analogy because you'll know what I'm talking about. But as to tell somebody, "Hey, if you swing the club forward, the ball will go further than if you swing it sideways." You know, once it's obvious to you, working with other people in that way becomes natural. It just becomes common sense. Until it's natural to you, until it's obvious to you, you would struggle, and I don't even recommend it. I often tell my clients a story early on when they say, "Are you asking me to change my leadership style? Are you telling me I have to change the way I manage my team? Are you telling me I have to change the way I do everything?" And I say, no, not at all. What I'm saying is that once you see what we're talking about, you will change your leadership style, and you will change your management style, and you will change the way you do pretty much everything. But not because I told you to, because it makes no sense to do it the old way anymore.
Yeah, because now it makes so much sense to me, of course. I mean, as we used to talk about, was the butterfly landed, the insight was there, and the thought I haven't thought before was there, and all of a sudden I could see it differently. But before that, I definitely was struggling a little bit at the time when I was like, okay, so I already have it inside. I can just sit here and wait and see whatever shows up. And it was like, okay, since none of the external circumstances has any way of determining my feelings, then nothing kind of matters. Should I just sit here and bask in a wonderful feeling, or is there something wrong with wanting success or being rich or being the best in the world at something? What's going on?
Well, and it turns out, and again, I didn't make this up, so it's not like, well, the way I make it up, It turns out that we have, as human beings, an inbuilt sense of direction. Every human being has a certain unfolding of desire, of wanting, that isn't about self-esteem and trying to prove something about themselves or prove something to other people. And it isn't about fixing something that's broken in themselves. That's just about wanting to create things in the world. We are natural creators. If you watch small children, once they have some motor skills, they're always building. They're always painting and creating and doing things. That's not because they're unhappy. It's because that's a natural expression of this life force that's inside us. And so, again, the reason we have all these forced activities, okay, I must make myself do this, and I must set goals, or I won't do anything, is just because we haven't yet seen that desire, it will carry us. It is enough, and it marks out even the path for us to follow if we let it. And it's one of those things, it's the only stage in the work that I do where, to a certain extent, I have to say to people, stay with this. Keep looking in this direction, and you will see it. And ask them, in a way, just to trust me long enough to keep looking. Not to trust me that it will work, because it works or it doesn't. I don't need anyone to not get results and then pretend that it's their fault because I said they should. I can tell you, I've done this for enough years with enough people, with tens of thousands of people, that if you keep looking in this direction, you will start to see this self-righting mechanism at work, this natural unfolding of a creative flow at work, you know, what I call innate well-being and innate wisdom. And this is a very silly example, but maybe it's a little more grounded for some people than what we were talking about. My wife and I have been together 23 years now, but when we were first together, she used to complain about what a messy person I was and how I never cleaned up. And I kind of thought she had a point, because I noticed, well, gee, she's right. I never have this impulse to tidy. Like, if I'm ever going to clean up, it's because she told me to, or I know she's going to tell me to if I don't. And then one day she went, probably a couple years into our relationship, she went away back to be with her family, with one of the kids. And for the first time since we'd been together, I was in the home alone for a week. About 3 days in, I noticed myself cleaning the house, vacuuming, and doing all these things. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's not that I don't have an inner impulse to look after my environment. It's just that she always jumped on it so quickly that my inner impulse never had a chance to come out. Yeah. And it's the same thing. If you are listening and going, but I don't have an inner self-righting mechanism. I don't have an inner gyroscope. I don't have an inner sense of direction. I don't have any experiences of that. It's not because it doesn't exist. It's because you've probably never let go of controls long enough in order to experience
that it's working.
Yeah. And often when people see this is in times of extreme crisis, when they've had to let go of the controls. So when people get very, very ill, when people have life-threatening illnesses, it's amazing to me. I've had the chance to work with so many people with life-threatening illnesses, and almost universally, they admit to me, and it's always kind of a little bit like a secret conversation they don't want me to share, that in many ways, this is the best thing that ever happened to them. It's for the first time in their life, they've let go of the controls, and they found out that everything's actually all right. You know, people who turn their life around after alcohol or drugs, usually it's because they've hit rock bottom. They've gotten to the point where they absolutely get so far out of control that they stop being able to even try. And suddenly that's when they see, oh, I've been working so hard to make this work. It's designed to work, and the thing that's been getting in the way of it working is me.
Yeah. On a much lesser level, I've had that with the athletes that I work with, but usually they get kind of, seduced by what they're doing. Like, for example, if a tennis player is playing badly and then all of a sudden they throw a tantrum, and they go like, to hell with this, I don't even care anymore, and they walk out and they play their best tennis ever and win, they don't realize that it was because they let go. They think it was because they got angry.
Right. Right, and that's what we do. Because we think it's an outside-in world, because we think it's what happens or what we do that determines how we feel and experience, we look to attribute our experience to something outside us.
Yeah.
And it's just superstition in a way. When you see that no, that's just natural. That flow state that athletes absolutely strive for, that's our natural state. That's where we are when we're not caught up in our own thinking that seems real to us now.
I think that's
a big point. You know, people talk about emotions, and they often when they hear this, they go, well, so are you saying we shouldn't feel emotions, or that we should only feel positive emotions? And here's how I understand it. Here's how it looks to me. Our emotions are our thinking. They're just like the flip side of a thinking. You know, a coin always has a heads and a tails. Well, our thinking, every thought has the thought and the feeling. It's two sides of the same coin. So we think a scary thought, we feel scared. We think an angry thought, we feel angry. We think a sad thought, we feel sad. We think a happy thought, we feel happy. So what your emotions will let you know is the quality of your thinking in any given moment. So if you're having a lot of low feelings, it just means you're having some low quality thoughts in that moment. And for whatever reason, they seem real to you. They don't just look like thoughts. They seem like, oh, no, this is really happening. My life really is over. My relationship really is over. I had a wonderful example. It happened last night. I got the payoff of the story. But a few weeks back, a friend of mine who I thought, my wife thought, had absolutely met the one. And this is, you know, he's in his 50s. So, you know, it's a long time coming. And he came over and he was very upset because they were going to break up. The relationship was over and it was never going to work out and all this story about why they had to break up. And we just talked to him and I particularly talked to him about this understanding moods and emotions a little bit more, that when people are in a low state of mind, their thoughts seem very real to them, and they're quite low quality thoughts. And so, if they don't know that that's all that's happening is that they've got some low quality thinking, that's the world, and the world is awful, and I have to do something about it. And when you're feeling low, when you're looking out at the world in a low state of mind, that's the worst possible time to make any kind of life decision, let alone a major life decision. And it's almost like those low feelings are like a check engine light on your car that let you know, oh, there's a problem. And when we try and fix our emotions and make ourselves feel better, that would be like trying to switch off the check engine light in the car without actually checking the engine.
Yeah.
What we do in the car is, when the check engine light comes on, as soon as we can, we slow down, we maybe pull over to the side of the road, and we take a look. Well, it works the same way in your head. If you're experiencing that check engine light, these lower moods, these lower quality emotions, that's time to pull back, pull off to the side, take a little break, take a look at what's going on in your head, and wait for the mood to rise back up. You know, for that self-correcting mechanism to do its job, and then you wake up the next morning and suddenly everything's fine. You know, something that seemed like such a big problem last night, this morning, it just doesn't seem like such a big deal. And you almost wonder a few days later, boy, what was I thinking? And that's exactly the right question. What were you thinking? You were thinking some really dark thoughts, and they looked real to you, and that's why you felt so dark. So the payoff to this story was, had this conversation with this guy, talked to him a lot about no mood, gave him a copy of Supercoach where we talk about, you know, in a chapter called, at least in English, it's called Rainy Days and Mondays. I'm not sure what it's called in Swedish, but that talks about the relationship between, you know, your thinkings and your emotions. And he came back yesterday to say that, you know, that conversation had saved their relationship, and they're now talking about having children and just really looking forward to a wonderful life together.
Mm. What a difference a day makes.
Yeah, what a difference a day makes indeed.
So what do you say to the people who listen to this, and of course, when they're in this, everything seems hectic to them. It might be that, well, I have a deadline. I can't sit around and wait until the morning. If I haven't got this ready by 6, you know, the boss is going to fire me. Or when a hockey player is out on the rink and he's saying, well, if I have a low mood now, I got to get it back in a second. I can't sit there and wait
well,
until tomorrow.
So it's a really good question, because I think those are the real questions. And there's, if I can, I'm going to try and divide that into two and answer it in two parts. So, you know, if you've got a deadline in the morning, you're on the ice and you know you've got to make the shot in the next 30 seconds, that's probably not a great time to be trying out a new way of seeing things.
No.
Like you're in it. You know, that's you know, it's in America there's a horrible expression, but it's kind of funny and apt. You know, wrong week to stop sniffing glue. This just isn't a good time to completely do everything new for the first time. You know, you've made it this far seeing the world the way you've seen it. You'll make it another day. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But when things calm down and settle down, and they will, that's when you can take a closer look. And then what happens, and I've seen this again and again and again, is when you suddenly take that closer look from a better place, what we're saying now that might sound sort of mysterious and a bit new age or out there becomes obvious. And you'll wonder how you ever saw it the other way. Because if you really think about this idea that our circumstances determine our moods and behavior, that's magical thinking. I mean, how on earth, show me the mechanism whereby your company making a decision or the other team scoring a goal, show me the mechanism whereby that can affect your behavior. See, that's magical to me. That would be some sort of airy-fairy crazy idea.
Well,
there's a missing link between those two that people don't somehow overlook. When you get really clear, you suddenly go, wow, no, that can't. There's no mechanism for that. All that can happen is I can have a thought about that, and if that thought seems real and important to me, if I buy into that thought, then I'll have the feeling that's just the flip side of that thought. And then that feeling and that thought will lead to more thoughts and more feelings that could absolutely take me out of my natural state of flow, drop me into a lower state of mind temporarily, and if I followed through on it, if I tried to push through it instead of pulling back, well, then I'm liable to make mistakes. I mean, that's true. I can absolutely, that's just common sense.
Yeah.
But the more you look, the more you see.
Yeah. The distinction that helped me a lot when I felt that I was sitting around waiting was that I had mixed it up in my head that I wasn't allowed to practice. That almost that, you know, what I tell a lot of the people that I coach now is that, you know, you practice to get better, not to feel better. You're already born with the well-being. And once you actually practice and get better, and when you know that you have your well-being, you'll do better. And I think that's where quite a few people get mixed up, because they think, oh, so I'm just going to be sitting there waiting for my fluffy little butterfly to land, or I'm going to wait for my well-being, and then I'll show up and I'll score the goal and I'll save the day. Yeah, but you still have to practice hockey.
Well, and I think this is beautiful, and it's one of the things that you've said before when we've talked that I really love is that distinction between that you practice to get better, not to feel better. Because what happens is we confuse qualities and skills. And we take a bunch of things that are actually innate and treat them as though they were skills that had to be practiced. And then we take things that are actually skills that have to be practiced and treat them as if they were innate. So people will say, oh, I'm just no good at golf. I'm just no good at sports. I'm just no good at math. I'm just no good at writing. I'm just no good at relationships. I'm just no good at talking in public. And all of those things are skills, but we talk about them as if they were innate qualities that you either have or don't have. And yet people will, in the same breath, say, yeah, I really need to practice meditation to still my mind. Yeah, I really need to practice thinking more positive thoughts. Yeah, I really need to practice being in a good feeling. Well, no, those are actually innate qualities that we all have. And you know, it is sometimes difficult, and you know this, it is sometimes difficult to have to be the one to tell somebody, hey, by the way, you have everything about 180 degrees backwards. But the second they actually see it, it's done. That's the beauty of it. It may take you a bit longer to see it, but once you see it, you don't have to practice it because that's natural. That's just how it works. The stuff for you to practice are the actual skills. And, you know, my favorite research, and I know you know this is the research as well, was the Anders Ericsson research into the 10,000 hours, that pretty much anyone who's mastered any skill has put in at least 10,000 hours of practice. And, you know, I always find it really funny that somebody will say to me, oh, I'm no good at selling. And I'll go, well, how much practice have you put in? And they'll go, what do you mean? Like, it hasn't even occurred to them that it's something you can practice. And I'll say, well, how much practice have you put in? And they go, well, I had a sales job for a month. It was awful. And it's like, you know, if you really pin them down, you'll find that most people have put in 10 to 50 hours maximum at the stuff that they think that they're just no good at. Well, of course you aren't. Now, that's not to say that some people don't just happen to, personality-wise, or just, you know, have a certain personality that lends itself to a sport. It's not to say that everybody has the same genetics and that if you put 10,000 hours in at a sport and I put 10,000 hours in the sport, we'll be at the exact same level. But it does mean that if we both put 10,000 hours in, we'll both be really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's, once again, going back to it, if you're a leader, you still need to go to some of the courses and read some of the books and actually go out and lead people. But to find your well-being, you don't have to do anything. That will come, and if you have practiced, once it comes, what comes out will be even better than before.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons that it's so rewarding to coach people at the high end. I know, you know, we both coach CEOs and top performers in their field, and it's so satisfying because they've already put in the hours to develop the skills. So when they get this, they suddenly unleash at an incredibly high level, and it's very exciting to see. Now, that doesn't mean that if you haven't put in the hours yet, you won't see benefits from it. Personally, you'll get benefits immediately because you start to feel better, you relax, the world looks so much less scary of a place, your relationships get much smoother and easier, you just have a much more clarity on a regular basis, and so life gets easier and better. But if you haven't develop the skills, it will still take some time to get to the point where you're able to produce the level of results that you probably want to be producing in the world.
Mm.
And that's just common sense. Anyone who thinks that you can shortcut that is either selling you something or buying something they're going to regret later.
Probably. That's back to the positive thinking or trying the law of attraction and saying, if I just think well enough, it will all materialize in my world. And sadly, you actually have to go out and do some of the work. The good thing is you can feel a lot better while you're waiting for the results to show up.
Yeah, and I think that's the joy of this. You know, for me, one of the things that I say a lot is look, worst case, if you look to your well-being, you find your innate well-being, you live in these better and better states of mind, worst case, you have a wonderful life. Best case, you have a wonderful life and drive a Porsche.
Yeah.
Because Because when you are at the level where you can produce the results consistently, you get that too. That's like a bonus. That's an add-on.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, you and I were talking a few weeks back and sharing a metaphor that George Pransky, somebody I know we both really enjoy his work, has about that the level of well-being is like the surface of a pond or a lake. And the goals we have for our career, for our finances, for all the external stuff are like boats on that lake. And that when the level of well-being rises, all that other stuff, all those performance things and all those results rise with it. The level of well-being goes down and the performance and results go down with it. And trying to make yourself happy by working on performance and results would be like lifting a boat and expecting the water to rise with it. A little bit of it might come up at first, but it'll quickly drip back down.
And it will be a struggle to keep it up there.
Oh, it's an incredible struggle because all you've got then is your own force of will. And I mean, look, there's no question about it. Some people have an incredible force of will, but they're never going to win against nature. I mean, that's why water always wins in the end.
Yeah, as soon as they relax, the boat goes plump back to the same level. And I guess that's where they got the idea that you can have a happiness set point, you know, like that's your water level. If you don't see that your well-being is innate, the water level stays where it is and the boat will eventually plop down to the place where you were before.
Yeah, and one of the beautiful things that I've found in my own life, and this is as somebody who, for those people who don't know, and there's no particular reason you should know if you don't know me, but I was a depressed, suicidal teen. I went through 7 years of major depression. And for me, had you talked to me back then, back when I still thought that it was all down to my circumstances and my condition and my brain chemistry and all these external factors, I would have said, well, the best I can hope for is being a little bit less miserable, you know, being, you know, and maybe having occasional moments of happiness. And I look back at that poor kid now, and I just think, wow, I am so grateful that that set point was nowhere near where I thought it was. Because I find on a sometimes even on a monthly basis, let alone on a yearly basis, that water level rises and rises and rises.
Yeah. So to finish this off for all the listeners out there and so forth, what would be a good way to send people home with? I mean, to encapsulate what we've been talking about, if you could give them whatever it is we can give them to kind of walk away thinking, I can see some of the direction you're talking about. What would be the finishing touch on this?
Well, I do think that in the same way as if I wanted to be able to go bird watching and see birds I hadn't seen before, I would use a guidebook, and if I got really into it, I would hire a guide. You know, go get a copy of Supercoach. Read Anders' tips on his website. Read my tips on my website. Come along on seminars. If at some point you get this enough that you really want to go deeper, hire a guide. Hire a coach who works in this way. I teach an academy that trains coaches to work in this way called Supercoach Academy. There's a growing number of people in the world who work at all different levels. Not everybody works at the CEO level like Anders and I. There's all sorts of people out there now who have seen enough that they can really begin to be effective as guides for other people. So I would certainly encourage you to do all that, but in the end, you know, if I had to just give one piece of advice, and I so would hate to ever be in a position where I had to just give one piece of advice, it would be just as best you can, relax and enjoy it. Because that's really what taking your hands off the controls looks like. If you can relax and enjoy your life, you're going to find more and more of the time your well-being comes to the surface, more and more of the time you're in a clear state of thinking, more and more of the time when you're trying to perform, you're able to perform in the zone and in the flow, and life will continue to get better.
Wow. Thank you, Michael. If anybody out there wants additional information, of course, you can go to supercoach.com, or you can visit my website at lifevision.se. And I hope that this was helpful to you listening out there, and that you found some insight or new thought that you haven't thought before. And thank you, and good luck to you all. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.